I'm pulling on my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time to drive to work. Okay, so I have been doing, I have a sort of an ongoing series where I'm trying to talk about every magic set ever made. And recently I've talked about Mercadian Masks and Nemesis. So obviously I need to finish up with the last set in the Mercadian Mask block, Prophecy. So let me first, I'm often asked, what is the worst magic set of all time, design-wise? And normally the answer I give is Homelands. But Homelands, like, was done by an outside group that had no previous experience. So while Homelands is my pick for the worst, Prophecy is the worst one that, like, we did internally. Like, of all the sets we did internally, I think Prophecy is our worst. And so today, I'm going to tell the story of how Prophecy came to be and why I consider Prophecy to be the worst internally designed magic set. Okay, so the story of Prophecy requires some setup. I need to explain sort of what was going on in R&D at the time. Okay, so Prophecy comes out, I think, in early 2000. So, right before Invasion. Okay, so here's what's going on. Richard Garfield invents magic, and he has a bunch of his playtesters start to make some of the early sets. Ice Age, Mirage, you know, and there's those same groups did Fallen Empires, did Antiquities, you know, did Alliances, did a lot of the early stuff, Visions and such. So, Richard decides that, you know, he's going to go on and make other trading card games. He's going to make Netrunner and Vampire the Eternal Struggle and Battletech. And anyway, there's lots of other games that Richard is going to go and make. So Richard's moving off of Magic. And a lot of the other people at the time, Skeff Elias, Jim Lynn, Dave Petty, a lot of the East Coast playtesters that came and worked at Wizards. Skeff became the brand manager for Magic, and Dave left, and Jim started getting more responsibility running R&D. And so, like, they were sort of, basically what happened was the people that were in charge of Magic were moving on to do other things. So they hired a new wave of designers, a new wave of R&D to sort of be in charge of Magic. And they hired four people. So they hired me, they hired Bill Rose, they hired Mike Elliott, and they hired William Jockish. And there was a year or two there where, like, probably from when we got hired in 95 to about 2000, the four of us were doing most of the development. We did eventually hire Henry Stern, so Henry's added to this group during this time. But it's not really till Invasion. Invasion is where, after the disaster that was Urza Saga, we decided to start hiring people off the Pro Tour. That's when we hire Randy Bueller and Mike Donay and Mike Turnian and Matt Place. And sort of we start getting a little more, what I would say, professional development. But during that five-year stretch, it was the five of us that were doing a lot of things. Now, early on, when they hired us, we weren't even hired as designers because there were a bunch of sets in the queue. Like, one of the first sets we worked on, first set I worked on was Alliances, then was Mirage, then was Visions. All that had been done already. And it's not till Weatherlight where we're like, oh, maybe we need to start making sets. In fact, we started on Tempest before we started on Weatherlight because Tempest was a large set. And for those that know my story, I pitched them to let me do Tempest because Richard said he'd work on it. Anyway, they let me do Tempest. But Weatherlight, Tempest, that era is the start of Wizards starting to make, or like R&D internally making its own designs. Before that, it was all done externally. But while we were starting to do designs, we didn't really go that much up in people. And so there was a period in time there where we were very stretched. For example, I did both Unglued and Urza's Destiny by myself. I was the design team. I mean, I had people submitting designs to me, but I mean, both cases, it was essentially I was doing the vast majority of the work. Bill did Portal by himself. Henry would later do Portal 3 Kingdoms by himself. That there was a lot of we were just stretched thin. And what had happened was, so Mike and I really want, when we were hired, Mike and I and Bill to some extent, we're all like, we're designers. And as time went on, we got more opportunity to do design. And the three, Mike, me, and Bill did a lot of design. But there were a lot of sets. And so Prophecy, William Jockish had said he would want, because he saw, like, everybody around him was leading sets, right? Was doing design. And so he saw me and Mike and Bill all doing design. He's like, I'd like to try to design a set. So, so when we got there, Joel Mick was sort of the head designer. And no, if you ever ask, whenever I talk about transitioning between head designers, I always talk about Invasion as kind of being the place where Bill started as head designer, when he became head designer. But reality is, he started in the middle of the previous block, kind of like Ravnica was my first full set, but I started in the middle of Mercadian Masks. He started in the middle of, I started in the middle of Champions Kagawa. Bill started in the middle of Mercadian Masks. So Prophecy was actually a set that I believe Bill was in charge of by the time, so Bill ended up being in charge of it. So that's important to the story. So what happens is William says, hey, I really like to design the set. We are just crammed. And so Bill says, okay, and lets William. So William mostly, I mean, he had a little bit of help, but William, I think the design team is listed as William. Oh, it's listed as William, me, and Bill, which tells me it was just William for the design. Bill and I will jump in at one point. We'll get to that. So what happens is, so let me talk a little bit about William. I don't know how much I've talked about William Jockish. I talk a lot about Bill and Mike. I've talked less about William. So basically, William, I believe, like Richard, I think was a math teacher. And he was interested in design. And I think he wrote a letter to Wizards, like just wrote a letter saying, I'm interested in a job. And somehow, and I don't know how, that letter got to Richard. And I think Richard read it, and he kind of saw himself in Richard. I mean, he saw William in himself. And so they decided to hire William. Bill, for example, got hired because he'd been one of the original playtesters. He was leading Mirage and Visions. I got hired because I started working for the Duelists and I was doing a lot of freelance work for the company. Mike got hired because he had met Joel, I think, at a convention and had been making his own set and impressed Joel with it. William definitely was sort of like the most, had the least amount of reps when he got hired. You know, the other of us had done something that at least they could look at and go, oh, well, they're doing this, you know. And what happened was when we got hired, like, I've told this story too. I really wanted to be a designer, but they're like, well, we're hiring developers. And I'm like, well, I will take the job as a developer and I will use my, once I'm inside the door, I will prove that I should be a designer. And eventually I did. I led Tempest. So I and Mike really wanted to be designers. I think Bill, I mean, the three of us were really interested in designing. William actually was kind of the original four of us, the one that was closest to what we think of as a developer slash, you know, play designer, someone who was actually interested in balance, in play balance. Now, in retrospect, looking back, I think William was by far the strongest of the four of us at doing that kind of thing. But I think as we got eventual, like, actual Pro Tour players, they were even better. But William had a very analytical mind, which will become very important as we get into Prophecy. William was definitely, I think he really enjoyed sort of the math of the game, if you will. And so what happens is William says he wants to design a set. Bill says fine. And like I said, I believe William went off and made a set, much like I had done Urza's Destiny. I think this was just William. Now, remember, Mercadian Masks, back in the day, the way blocks worked was the large set would happen in the fall. These are Northern Hemisphere seasons. What happened in the fall, it would have two keywords, usually named. For Katie Mass, they weren't named. And then the following two sets would not invent new things normally, but or at least wouldn't invent new named things, and would expand upon what was going on. So the two-ish main mechanics from Mercating Math. First is, I will combine Rebels and Mercenaries into a singular mechanic, although they're slightly different. What Rebels let you do is you could spend mana and tap it to fetch a Rebel out of your deck that costs one more than the card that was fetching it. Mercenaries got you a card that costs less than the one fetching it. And so Rebels let you go up, Mercenaries let you go down. Surprise, surprise, Rebels were the strong one. But what happened was Rebels and Mercenaries kind of got a bit, or not Mercenaries, Rebels kind of got out of control. And so really all the third set did was make answers to Rebels and Mercenaries. There was like a card that let you shuffle a Rebel into the library or shuffle a Mercenary in. The Rebels and Mercenaries were more anti the Rebel and Mercenary theme. I think there was one more actual Mercenary, though Mercenaries weren't the dangerous thing. I don't even think there was a new Rebel that actually fetched out creatures. And then the other big thing was Spell Shapers, which were creatures that you could spend mana and discard a card to generate an effect. The way I like to think of it, it wasn't technically what happened, but is you were kind of turning the card in your hand into the spell that you could then cast. We would end up with one cycle of Spell Shapers, but I don't think William put them in. I think Bill and I would later put them in. A legendary cycle. We'll get to that. So anyway, William goes off and makes a set. And so what William is fascinated with is the idea of the tension that comes about with sort of how many land you have and what's tapped. And so William starts playing around in the space. So the mechanic, William makes a mechanic. It's not named, but he designs a mechanic called Ristic. And it's in the sum of the names. It was our nickname for it. I don't think it was keyworded Ristic. So what Ristic was is, it was something that you got that was cheaper than normal, but your opponent had the ability to stop it if they spent a certain amount of mana. And sometimes it was a spell, sometimes it was a triggered ability. It could be different things, but the idea essentially is, I will get this thing unless you pay mana. And then he had a bunch of effects that cared about either your lands being tapped, that you got sort of rewarded, you got punished if your lands were untapped and rewarded if your lands were tapped. And there was a bunch of spells that require you to sack lands to do something. And so there's this very tight, intricate puzzle of, there's a lot of things that are sort of, my land is so many different things. Do I want to use the land to save for Ristic spells? Do I want to tap it to get rewards for having tapped land? Do I want to sacrifice it as a cost for things that want me to sacrifice my land? And William made this really intricate web of... like, it was a very, very, very spiky set. It was very much a set where you had to make minute decisions about how exactly you're using your mana for the turn, which was really fascinating to William. So, my earliest memory of Prophecy was Bill talks to me one day, he goes, okay, I need you to look at William's set. And he goes, just look at the set and then come talk to me. So I get the set, I mean, William had been working on it, I hadn't seen it, so I go in, I look at it, I read it all, and I remember going to see Bill, we were meeting in a room, like, we had a little conference room, and my jaw was just, I'm like, what? I said, oh my goodness. I think William made the most unfun set ever. And the inherent problem is that William really made a set that was so narrow in appeal. I'm not saying there aren't players that don't appreciate what William had done. There are. But two big problems. One, it's a small minority. And the second is, for those not in that minority, for the people that don't enjoy that nuance of, it just did things that players didn't want to do, most players. For example, sacrificing lands. That isn't a fun thing. basically, if you set, like, when you give, one of the things we've learned over time is when you give players the ability to do things, they will do them. If I say sack lands for an effect, they'll sack the lands. But the problem is then they don't have the lands. And that one of the big things about Magic is what you don't want to do is encourage play patterns that then force players into unfun situations. You know, regular listeners will say to me, I say all the time, like, put the fun, you want to have the fun, and it's kind of, you can't avoid the fun. In order to do what the set's asking you to do, you must stumble through the fun. And this was kind of the opposite, where if you did what the set asked, it was making you stumble through the unfun. And like Rhystic, for example, one of my comments about Rhystic was, so one of the most polarizing aspects of Magic is counter magic, counter spells. Rhystic was like, what if we made spells that just had a counter spell built in? It's like, okay, I can cast a spell, and I give my opponent a free counter spell to counter it. I mean, they have to have the mana to do it, but it's like, you know, I mean, and William's idea of Rhystic was, oh, well, I have to work around that, and if mana's up, then I can't do it. Like, or I want to push it and make them want to use their mana. So, like, it just wasn't fun. It wasn't fun. And I'm not sure whether Prophecy was Bill's very first set he was in charge of. Maybe he was in charge of Nemesis. But Bill was like, this was early in Bill's, you know, being head designer. And so he goes, okay, we gotta work on this. And so what we ended up doing is, I think Bill and I made three main cycles. These are the three that I remember. We went through and we did a lot to try to clean stuff up, and we did a lot of tweaking, and just the problem was that the core things that William was doing were, it was hard to salvage in them. They just weren't fun things. Rhystic is not a fun thing. Sacrificing land is not a fun thing. Caring about whether you're tapped, maybe, but just the way it was executed, because it was balanced against other things. So I remember that we went in and we said, okay, the problem with this set is super, super spiky. We need some stuff for Timmy and Johnny. You know, we just needed some stuff that was splashy. So we added three cycles that I remember. I mean, we did more than that, but there were three big cycles we had. So one was we added the avatars. So the avatars were 8 mana creatures that cost 6 and 2 colored mana. And then there was a condition. And the condition leaned into what that color wants to be doing. And it said, okay, if this condition is true, this costs 6 less. And so the idea was it was an 8 mana creature that was pretty impressive. But I mean, 8 mana is a lot of mana. But under the right conditions, you could cast it for 2 mana. We then made a cycle of the winds. And I think the winds, how much did the winds cost? The winds cost 9 mana. So they were giant spells, but they did big splashy effects. Like, just the idea was, okay, you got to get there. But if you get there, holy moly, this is an amazing giant effect. And then we made the cycle of legendary spell shit. The other thing, one of the other notes is, there's nothing Mercadian Masks really in the set, I think, when William turned it over. Now, given the third set tended to drift the most, but there was, like, very, very, like, we had to feel like it was the same block. So Bill and I made the cycle of, we made a cycle of legendary creatures. I think you had to sacrifice 2 cards rather than 1 card. But again, big effects. So really what what Bill and I did is we went into Prophecy and just made big splash effects. The avatars, the winds, the spell shapers. Just so the idea is, if you want something splashy and big and fun, it was there. So the set ended up being okay. I think Bill and I added enough sort of splashy things that there's plenty in the set that I mean, there's stuff people remember from the set. I'm going to go through some of the cards. But it was definitely that the memory of Prophecy was that I do like the idea of let different people have a vision and let them do what they're going to do. And sometimes you get really amazing things. Sometimes you let someone loose and you let someone make a set who's never made a Magic set. And they just do cool things you've never seen before. And while William did things we'd never seen before, that's one of the big things with Prophecy. Is I think often, for example, when you're designing, one of the normal problems that happen, I think, with designers is the idea that you get too narrow into your own sort of game space. Meaning, you know what you like about Magic, and you just turn that up to 11. It's like, this is a set that I, as a player, would absolutely love. And the problem is, A, not every player is you. And B, some people, they don't represent a mass majority of the players. And C, the set has to be for everybody. So even if your set has a certain vantage point, there still needs to be stuff for other people there. Kind of what Bill and I did, is just added some other stuff into the set. Okay, so I'm going to start talking through some of the cards. And I'm going to use the cards to sort of talk about some of the challenges. So, Rhystic Study, which is probably the most famous card from this set. I don't say that in a good way, but it's played a lot. So it's an enchantment for 2 and a blue. And it says, whenever an opponent plays a spell, unless they pay 1, you get to draw a card. I think the idea here is, I'm going to do this interesting taxing. And what I'm going to do is my opponent's spells cost 1 more. But they have the option of not paying that 1, but then I get to draw a card. But the net result of it is, having every spell you tax be taxed by 1 is... What just happens is you, the player of Rhystic Study, just draw lots of cards. And in a way that's not... It's unfun tension. You want some amount of tension, but the reality is, if I play this for my 3 mana, most of it's going to happen, I'm just going to draw a lot of cards because my opponent's like, I really need to cast this spell, so I guess draw a card. I mean, in multiplayer play, Commander's where Rhystic Study seems to play. Sometimes people pay it. If you're not going to do anything else with the mana anyway, you'll pay it. So it's not like it never gets paid. It comes up. But I'm not sure it's a particularly fun game. It's used a lot because it's efficient, unless you draw a lot of cards, and drawing a lot of cards is good. But it's the kind of card when it comes down, people that sort of go, eh. Okay, next, Spore Frog. So Spore Frog is green, a 1/1, and you sacrifice it to Fog, which is prevent all combat damage that turn. So the reason this card came about, I think I made Spore Frog, believe it or not, was that, I'm trying to think, we had made a bunch of spells over the years where they were 1 mana, 1/1s, for 1 colored mana that you could sack to do an effect. Like, I made Mog Fanatic, that's a 1/1 for red, that you can sack to do 1 damage in Tempest. And I think we had made enough of them that the players recognized them as a cycle. And so this was made to be the green one, so that green had a 1/1 you could sack. It turns out that free fog, in general, you might notice we don't do a lot of fog effects anymore. Fog effects really have proved to be, they just tend to gum up the board. It's sort of like one of the ways you're able to break through. Like, one of the inherent issues with Magic is that defenses are a little bit stronger than offenses when it comes to creatures, and that a lot of what we need to do is we want to make it advantageous to attack. And one of the reasons it's advantageous to attack is, okay, I have better forces than my opponent. They're going to have to make trades that aren't beneficial to them, that I can sort of attack because I have superior forces. And fog really shuts that down in a way. And it's kind of important that the game can do that. So we've been really pulling back on fogs. But anyway, the reason this card is played so much is free fog is good. Okay, foil. So foil was part of a cycle. So it's 2 blue instant. It counters target spell. But you could cast it for free if you discard an island and another card. So another theme that was in Mercadian Mass, it is carried out here, was the idea of alternate casting costs. So the original ones, the pitch spells were in alliances. You could, Force of Will, you have to pitch another blue card and pay 1 life. So the idea here is, what if you had to discard 2 cards rather than 1 card? And then, playing into William's theme of caring about lands as a resource, we made one of those cards the basic land of that color to make sure that you're playing it. And then once we did that, the other card could be any, it didn't need to be of the color anymore. So this one doesn't require you to discard blue. You just got to discard an island and a card. But if you have islands in your deck, you're playing blue is the idea. So this is a cycle, all of which you discarded the basic land and a card. Foil was the best one. I will get to another one in a second. But they were, those were pretty good. Avatar of Woe, 6BB, 6/5. It's an avatar. And it has fear, meaning killing black by black or artifact creatures. And it has tap, destroy target creature. It can't be regenerated. And if in all graveyards there are 10 or more creatures, you can cast this for black blacks. It costs 6 less. Now, Avatar Woe was the strongest of the avatars. I think all the avatars, or many of the avatars, were pretty well received. Avatar Woe was the most powerful one. But the idea here is if things are dead, if a lot of things have died, which black is good at doing, you can get a 2-mana 6/5 that taps to kill things. That's very exciting. That was kind of the goal of the avatars. Okay, Citadel of Pain. It's an enchantment that costs 2 and a red. At the end of each turn, the end of each player's turn, that player, this enchantment does X damage to them, where X is the number of untapped lands. So this is playing to the theme I said earlier, where you really wanted to use all your mana, that you get punished. So that's, and this is where some of the tension I'm talking about. If you don't use all your mana, Citadel of Pain can punish you. But if you use all your mana, then you don't have the mana available for Ristic. That's the kind of tension that William was creating, was the idea that, oh, well, you could leave your mana up for Ristic, but if you do, then other things can punish you. That was the kind of and like I said, not particularly fun. It's like, oh, if I leave mana up, then I can counterspell you, but if I do, then I take damage. But anyway, Citadel of Pain is interesting in that it just really says, hey, I want you to actively be doing things. It tends to go in red decks. I mean, it's a red card. Because it goes in aggro decks because it's like, okay, well, I'm going to tap all my stuff every turn because that's just the nature of what I'm doing. Okay, next is Plague Wind. So 7BB, so 9 mana. It's a sorcery. Destroy all creatures you don't control. They can't be regenerated. For some reason, both Avatar Woe and Plague Wind, a lot of our destruction effects in black at the time were berry effects, we used to call them, meaning that you couldn't regenerate from them. I don't know why we always regenerated so much. I think Richard did it in Alpha. We just, oh, this is what black does. And eventually, we're like, okay, black doesn't need to constantly always regenerate. Why even have regeneration if every time you kill something, you always regeneration? So we did eventually stop doing that. So Plague Wind is an example of the winds. It's a 9-mana spell, but it is splashy. It's Wrath of God, except not for your creatures. And so that is pretty cool. Like, destroy everybody else's creatures. And Plague Wind, the two black cards, Avatar of Woe and Plague Wind, I think were the two most popular of the avatars in the winds. And they both can go in the same deck. Not always, but they can go in the same deck. Okay, next is Alexi's Cloak. So Alexi's Cloak costs 1 and a blue. It's an enchant creature. It's got Flash. Flash didn't exist yet, but it has Flash written out. And it grants the enchanted creature Shroud, which did not exist yet, so it was written out. So the idea is, it's kind of a protective spell, which is, if you're going to target my spell to destroy it, I can Flash in the spell. Now, once the spell's on it, it can't be the target of any spells by me or anybody else. But the idea was, it was a way to save things. This is not the first card to have Flash, but this is one of the earlier auras to have Flash. And the idea that the concept is, it's kind of a spell that then lingers on. And that's something we've been playing around a little bit. Remember, by the way, you'll notice a lot of enchantments in the set. One of the other things that William definitely played around with is just having more enchantments. The set has a little more enchantments in it. So there's a little... It wasn't enchantment matters, but William was fascinated by enchantments, so there was a lot of enchantments in here. Okay, next is Overburden. It's 1 and a blue. It is an enchantment. Hold on 1 second. It is an enchantment. What does it do? It's an enchantment that says, whenever a creature enters the battlefield, its controller has to bounce one of their lands. So the idea is it sort of stops you from ramping up, and if you play the more than one creature in a turn, you start going down in how much mana you have. Another not particularly fun card. A lot of the cards I'm talking about do get played because they're powerful, That was probably one of the other issues is, not only did William make a lot of unfun things, but he made powerful unfun things, meaning they're the kind of things that you do feel inclined to play because they're very potent. But they just create situations that are like, is that fun? Okay, if I play creatures, I don't get any land. Like, I mean, it really, really shuts down a lot of strategies that use creatures. And like I said, I don't know, this, you can see my ongoing theme here. Next is Abolish. So this is the white member of the alternate casting cost. It's one white, destroy target, artifact, or enchantment. So it's like a disenchant. But you could discard a Plains and another a card to play it. So it's kind of a free disenchant. So that seems to play. Next is Entangler. Two white. It's an enchant creature. Enchanted creature can block as many creatures as you want. That is an ability that we stopped doing for two reasons. One is just people don't tend to block with a lot of creatures, and multiple blocking, just, we didn't find it to be, it mostly shut things down. So it's like effects like this just shut up the board. And once again, we're always trying to encourage aggressiveness on the board to make the game end. The other thing is digital came to us, and it's really hard to program. So it shut down. In general, it kept attacking from happening, and it was bad for digital. So we really don't do digital blocking anymore. Infernal Genesis, 4BB enchantment. Each turn, the player of the enchantment puts the top card of the library into their hand, and they make that many 1/1 black minion tokens equal to the mana value of the card. So it's kind of also a black card draw in black, which is a little off for black. Rhystic Tutor. So this is a sorcery for 2 and a black. It lets you go get any card out of your deck. Demonic Tutor, essentially, although Demonic Tutor was a little too cheap. For 2 and a black. But if your opponent pays 2, they stop it. So once again, in Alpha was Demonic Tutor. It was 1 and a black, go get anything. That proved too well. I think we later realized that it's supposed to be like 3 and a black. So this is 1 cheaper than that, but your opponent can stop you if they have 2 mana. So you kind of have to wait till they can't stop you. And the final one I'll talk about today is Noxious Field. 1 black, enchant land. It gives enchanted land, tap, deal 1 damage to each creature and each player. So like I said, there's a decent amount of cards from Prophecy that do see some play. I don't know how much of these cards that I've listed make games more fun. Some of these cards are fine. I think some of them are splashy and fine. I think some of them are stuff like Rhystic Study. I don't know if that is adding net fun to the game. But anyway, you know, the interesting thing, I mean, Prophecy was definitely us, was us sort of trying something different. I think in the end, it was not, like I said, it is my list of the worst internally made Magic set. We knew better than that. It creates a lot of unfun play patterns. So anyway, that's my, so just to finish up the Mercadian Mask block, this is the third set. I don't think the Mercadian Mask block as a whole was a high point for us. I think the Rebel mechanic ended up being like, kind of the big takeaway from Urza Saga was we needed to get more professional developers, which we did, starting with Invasion. Mercadian Mask, we lowered the overall power level, but I still think Mercadian Mask suffered from a lot of developmental issues. The Rebel mechanic was just too good. I do like Spell Shapers. I do think alternate casting cost is interesting. I think we made a bunch that were probably too good. But anyway, Mercadian Mask was an okay block. It proved we needed better development, which we then got for the next block. It was probably a little weaker in some way. I don't know. I look back and I'm like, you know, there's blocks we did that really shined and were the pinnacle of what Magic could be. I don't think Mercadian Mask block was that. But anyway, I hope you've enjoyed these 3 podcasts walking through the Mercadian Mask block. I will continue in the future doing more of these podcasts. Like, my goal is to fill in and talk about every Magic set. And so I started from the very beginning. A bunch of sets I've already talked about. So I'm sort of walking through and saying, oh, what have I talked about? So I don't know what comes next. I haven't done my research yet. But whatever comes next, I will do that in a little bit. So anyway, I hope you enjoy these walkthroughs on the series. They're interesting for me to tell. And I get to think back to the past, so it's reminiscent for me. But anyway, guys, I'm at work, so we all know what that means. It means the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.